Tony, the biography obviously very much a public document, and something that does come out very clearly from it is the very deep love and affection between the two of them. Do you feel that Ursula was an inspiration for the music?
I think Vaughan Williams was a self-contained visionary person. I mean, obviously outside things made impressions on him, and I'm not sure that those kind of impressions are in any way important to understanding the music. That's the main thing. People get it wrong, for instance, when they say that, and we know this, it's been argued over and over again, that the Fourth Symphony and all its violence is to do with the politicizing of the time. But in fact, he started to conceive of that work before the Nazis took over in 1933, and that the Fifth Symphony was a vision of peace in the middle of the war. But the conception was beginning to take shape sometime before the war, and he often himself said that we should not look to outside circumstances but just listen to the music. And I'm not sure whether his relationships with his wife or with Ursula, subsequently wife, did anything more than please and comfort him. I don't know whether they provided inspiration.
Well, actually, that very particular point about whether or not one should read a programme into his music is something that we do have a letter from Vaughan Williams to his friend Robert Longman about, and he is in fact talking exactly about that, about the Fourth Symphony. Dominic.
I spent yesterday in bed nursing a cold, so I decided to try to answer your long and splendid letter of a long time ago. One. I agree with you that all music must have beauty. The problem being, what is beauty? So when you say you do not think my F minor symphony beautiful, my answer must be that I do think it beautiful. Not that I did not mean it to be beautiful, because it reflects unbeautiful things, because we know that beauty can come from unbeautiful things, e.g. King Lear, Rembrandt's School of Anatomy, Wagner's Nibelungs, etc. As a matter of fact, one, I am not at all sure that I like it myself now. All I know is that it is what I wanted to do at the time. Two, I wrote it not as a definite picture of anything external, e.g. the state of Europe, but simply because it occurred to me like this. I can't explain why. I don't think that sitting down and thinking about great things ever produces a great work of art. At least I hope not, because I never do so. And when you state your belief in me, dear Bobby, I feel the completest of frauds. A thing just comes. Or it doesn't. Usually doesn't. I always live in hope, as all writers must, that one day I shall ring the bell. In younger days, when one thought one was going to do the real thing each time, and each time discovered one hadn't done it, one said hopefully, next time. But when one touches on 65, one begins to wonder.
So Vaughan Williams himself there warning us against trying to read too literalistically into his music. Mm. But at the same time, I mean, one thinks of other things that influence him. I mean, politics is one thing you mentioned there. But of course, he also visited New York, and people have said sometimes there's a sort of steely quality to the Fourth. And one thinks of his description in one of his letters of the Plaza Hotel and the kind of steel skyscraper yes. canyons of New York.
Well, I mean, who can say? Listening to that letter, it's all very well saying him saying things just happen. But then your next question is, why? Why did the Fourth Symphony happen at that time? And you really cannot answer that question. He might have got up one morning and all of a sudden thought, I'll do something like that. And he did it. And don't forget also that although it sounds, a lot of people felt it was the beginning of a new dissonant modernism in Vaughan Williams. I mean, it's Michael Kennedy who's quite rightly said, actually, it's not the beginning of a new phase in Vaughan Williams at all. It's the ending of an old phase, because we've heard music like that in Sancta Civitas, in the piano concerto, and this was a climactic expression of all that kind of thing. And immediately after, he moved on into other areas and didn't actually follow up on that particular language. It's almost unique in his output. And the fascinating thing is that it's absolutely pure Vaughan Williams from beginning to end. Nobody could have written it but him, and yet there aren't any other pointers back to it from later.
So what does that mean when, as tonight, we hear it as part of a programme of three consecutive symphonies? Because, of course, we're hearing the fourth and then the fifth and then the sixth.
Well, I mean, this is going to be an absolutely fascinating experience because they obviously all tie up together, and you'll see things, little occasions in the fourth symphony, which you'll find in the later symphonies, just little links which mean that they're by the same person. But they live in three different worlds, and this is an incredible thing. I remember at the time of Vaughan Williams' last works, and then around the time of his death, some commentators on his music were daring to mention the name of Beethoven in relationship to Vaughan Williams. And, of course, immediately afterwards, other people thought that this was much too pretentious, fancy comparing Vaughan Williams with Beethoven. But after the years, and I've known these symphonies now for nearly 60 years, I do feel that there's only one other man I know of, I'm not saying that Vaughan Williams is as great as Beethoven, but who actually inhabits totally different worlds in his symphonies, like Beethoven 5, 6, 7, all live in totally different worlds, and they are all obviously by Beethoven. Listen to Vaughan Williams 3, 4, 5, and 6, and each one lives in an utterly different world, and that they're all by the same man. This is a phenomenal achievement, and I think this makes Vaughan Williams one of the truly great composers. And I didn't dare say this about 30 years ago, because people would have laughed at me, but I don't care whether they laugh at me now. He is a truly great composer on the strength, at least, of those four achievements, each one totally different, each one unified by his imagination. They all ring that bell.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for right now, so many thanks to Anthony Payne and to our reader, Dominic Rowan.
Rana Mitter presented that Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Zahid Worley, and Anthony Payne sitting just below me here in the Royal Albert Hall, entranced by the music he's hearing. Welcome back to the hall from me, Martin Handley, and to the second half of this BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the Proms. Tonight's orchestra is the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and together with its associate guest conductor, Andrew Manzi, they're tackling a trio of Vaughan Williams symphonies, which demonstrate the huge range of his orchestral writing. We began tonight with the brutal fourth, followed by the serenity of the fifth. In the sixth symphony, which we hear now, Vaughan Williams sprang the biggest surprise of his symphonic career. I asked Andrew Manzi what he thinks VW set out to achieve.
He's brave. The thing I think of straight away is that he brings a saxophone into the orchestra. It's like challenging the whole establishment of what an orchestra is and what a symphony is. He brings an instrument from the jazz club. And I think it shows that although he's getting on a bit as a composer, he's really wanting to break new ground. But he doesn't want to show too much. He's quite a private man. But actually, when he's sitting there writing the music, he's showing an awful lot. I just think he doesn't want us to analyse it and put it in words. It's maybe painful enough for him to have exposed it in the symphony.
No, of course. I mean, he was, you know, always against people who were saying that the fourth was a, you know, the state of Europe in 1935, and that the sixth was post-war and the atomic apocalypse and so on. But then he did say about, you know, our little life rounded by a sleep, and you can hear something of that in the finale, can't you?
Yes. I definitely think you can. I think he's feeling, after the Second World War is finished, the loss greater than he's feeling the triumph that the war is finished. And that's what the symphony is perhaps is about, is an expression of loss and grief. I do hear post-atomic Holocaust in the finale. He's very cross with me for saying that, but I can't help but hear it. But it still applies in 2012. It still has this power.
Andrew Manzi, well, one new facet of the symphony is that the four movements are linked to form a continuous whole. As Vaughan Williams put it, each of the first three has its tail attached to the head of its neighbour. Symphony was first performed in 1948, was immediately popular, audiences seeming to accept the obvious change of direction in the music from the profound piece of the fifth. If the sixth, with its restless, adventurous energy, felt like a negation of that piece, then it also seemed to be an intense affirmation of humanity. Music riddled with tensions. often strident, dissonant. And even more extraordinary when you remember that Vaughan Williams was in his mid-70s at the time he completed it. Well, BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's ready and waiting on the platform, and they're joined by their associate guest conductor, Andrew Manzi, to perform Vaughan Williams' 6th symphony. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Words from Prospero's Farewell in Shakespeare's Tempest, which Vaughan Williams said were the nearest he could get to describing that extraordinary last movement. They seem to encompass a vast emptiness. The sleep we come from and return to, in which case the other three movements may be life, storms and dramas leading to the final mystery. Vaughan Williams' Sixth Symphony, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3 to end tonight's BBC Prom by the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, guest leader Lucy Gould, conducted by Andrew Manzi. And the first thing he did was bring Stella McCracken, principal oboe, to her feet. Again, all sorts of people asking what he meant by the symphony. Vaughan Williams retorted, "I suppose it's never occurred to these people a man might just want to write a piece of music." A war symphony? Well, Andrew Manzi thinks there's something in that. The percussion section of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra brought to its feet. Vaughan Williams did admit that sinister dance band-like saxophone tune was written in response to the killing of a jazz band leader in a German bombing raid. Up come the trumpets. It's going to be round the orchestra now. They'll want to get home before the John Cage Centenary Mega Spectacular tomorrow, curated and conducted by Ilan Volkov. As for Andrew Manzi, well, he's off his first visit to mostly Mozart in New York before returning to his orchestra in Helsingborg for his first Sibelius II. That applause for the entire woodwind section of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. And it only remains to bring the strings to their feet. I asked Andrew Manzi whether he thought Vaughan Williams still underrated as a symphonist, and his reply was, "Not by the people who know the symphonies. The hardest thing is to get people in through the door to listen to them. If they've decided Vaughan Williams' music is old-fashioned, solid and worthy, well, I hope, and I'm sure Andrew does, that as a result of tonight's journey, people revise their image of the composer to someone whose brave humanity bursts out from every page of the three scores we've heard." Certainly they've infused this very large audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Andrew Manzi coming back into it. But as he does, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you. Yes, indeed, a prom to remember. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And ways of hearing that prom again include the iPlayer online for the next 7 days. There'll also be a chance to hear the prom broadcast again here on Radio 3 on Friday, the 31st of August at 2 in the afternoon. As for tomorrow night at the Hall...
Music is everywhere. You just have to have the ears to hear it. The words of John Cage, who was born 100 years ago. The BBC Proms marks Cage's centenary with music played from every corner of the Royal Albert Hall. Ilan Volkov curates and conducts an evening of John Cage at the BBC Proms. Live on Radio 3, tomorrow night, from 7:45.
Well, back to tonight, and in just under 5 minutes, highlights from the BBC Proms Inspire Young Composers Concert. The Aurora Orchestra are performing the winning entries from this year's Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. And after it, Percy Grainger is in the spotlight. Aspects of Grainger is the subject of the essay this week in the Radio 3 evenings. And tonight, Lucy Parham will be looking at Grainger the pianist, the golden pianist he was sometimes called, and he was even mentioned in the same breath as Horowitz and Rachmaninoff. That's Aspects of Grainger tonight at 10:45. And an aspect of Grainger right now. Thank you. Wally on the Shore by Percy Grainger, the English Chamber Orchestra there, conducted by Stuart Bedford. And as I say, Grainger, the pianist, is the subject of tonight's The Essay here on Radio 3 at 11:15. It's a little after 5 to 10, and now BBC Proms Inspire, which took place earlier this month. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Thousands of young musicians have been intimately involved in the BBC Proms for this one extraordinary and extraordinarily busy weekend. We've had youth orchestras from all over the UK playing in the Royal Albert Hall alongside the professionals, youth choirs, and the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain's annual prom, playing new pieces by Anna Meredith and Nico Mouly alongside Messiaen's immense Tarangalila Symphony. And just across the road, Proms Inspire has invaded the Royal College of Music again this year. Workshops and concerts where budding composers aged 12 to 18 can share ideas, they can experiment with new tools and techniques, they can work with professional musicians and meet other composers. And as part of Proms Inspire over the last few months, hundreds of the students have been sending in their pieces to a judging panel which has picked their favourites, and we're going to hear the three winning pieces performed by members of the Aurora Orchestra and conductor Nicholas Collin. I'll also be catching up with the composers to find out about their music, as well as eavesdropping on the improvisation, graphic notation and electronic workshops that have been in full swing all day. I'm with composer Stephen Montague, who's been running one of the workshops in the Royal College of Music's Parry Rooms today. Graphic scoring, and I saw the billing, Stephen, that is in the little introduction to the Proms Inspire Day, and it described it as extreme sonic adventure. So what are you trying to say to the students here?
Well, I think what this was an attempt to do is to put in the context of where the graphic score is in history. And of course, you know, in the 9th century, there were kind of graphic scores as to how to remember Gregorian chant. So we kind of went through the centuries up to the 20th century and into Earl Brown, December 1952, which is probably the first contemporary graphic score. And it's mostly to sort of loosen up the students to see alternative ways of writing music that can be effective, punchy, and actually deal with a sound world that is still can be exciting.
So a new way of expressing yourself on paper, effectively, isn't it?
Well, it's not a new way. It's an old way that has been forgotten. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to reintroduce some of these old tricks, you know, by an old dog teaching the new kids some new tricks. So I'm just trying to kind of open up their world to some of the things that I learned, expand their experience to something that I think is very valuable in the firmament of music, new music.
Now, Nicky, you've been in Stephen's workshop this afternoon. Were you used to any of these kind of ways of expressing yourself on paper, or is this new to you?
It's reasonably new. I mean, I've seen some types of graphic scores before, but I'd definitely never seen certainly most of the stuff from before the 20th century. Looking at all the monk chants, how they used to notate their music, that's really interesting, and I found it quite strange because I didn't actually know they had to remember so much music, so I can see now why they came up with the notation that they did.
What sort of impact do you feel it could have on you as a composer yourself? Do you feel that it does sort of extend your manuscript vocabulary, if you like, give you new possibilities?
Yeah, definitely, because, you know, Stephen said to us that there's a lot of things that Sibelius can't do, and I think there's a lot of effects and even sounds that you can't actually achieve without some kinds of these. You sort of create your own key in a way, and yeah, you can show people different sort of ways of bringing in and out instruments and that kind of thing that is really difficult to do accurately on paper, usually with normal notation methods.
So there's a new kind of accuracy about the way you're expressing yourself.
Yeah, I suppose a lot of it is less kind of in the sense of counting and like when does this beat come where, but instead you actually have a visual thing to bring you in or show you where to play which bits. So it definitely helps ensemble skills as well, because it helps everyone listen to each other, and you can all work together to listen to what one person is doing and take that and use it when you play your piece.
Now let's hear the first winning piece from the Young Composers Competition. It's called Mirmish. It's by 17-year-old Alex Wolfe. And Alex, it's inspired by W.B. Yeats, a passage of Yeats. So what's the story and how's it become music?
Well, there was just six lines of text that really struck me from this poem by Yeats. And it seems to encapsulate such a strong narrative, and it has a huge emotional breadth in such a small space of time. And for this competition, where our pieces have to be under 5 minutes, it seemed to have the perfect sense of clarity for the piece that I wanted to write.
Now, what's the poem?
The poem is called The Mermaid, I believe, by Yeats, and it's just these six lines from it. It's all about a young lad who's swimming at sea, and the mermaid kind of fixates on him, and they kind of get entangled, and eventually it says she forgets that even lovers drown, and it's just got this little twist at the end, and it's quite poignant and quite beautiful, I thought.
And how have you actually drawn the characters into the score? And what should we listen out for?
Well, it's for bassoon and string quartet, so initially quite an unconventional ensemble. I thought of the string quartet as both the sea and the mermaid, kind of drawing and enticing the bassoonist's young lad, the young swimming lad, in, if you like. And they get intertwined, the cello and the bassoon particularly press into each other with the same note and a semitone apart, and I've tried to capture the sort of both the kind of ecstatic feeling in the poem and the reverse of that.
And why Mirmish, not quite a mermaid?
Mirmish, well, I love the Harry Potter books, and the mermaids in those speak this funny language, which is not necessarily how you expect mermaids to speak, and it's called Mirmish in the Harry Potter books. I thought this might be my interpretation of the language of the mermaids.
Thank you.
A Swimmer Drowned by an Over-Amorous Mermaid. That's Mermish by Alex Wolfe, one of our two junior winners of the BBC Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. And you'll hear the other one and our senior winner just a little later. Listening to the practical improvisation workshop this afternoon, the subject of which is groove. Now, Jules Buckley, this is your workshop. Define groove. You have 10 seconds.
Well, groove should be anything that's locked into a point that's making people want to move.
Can you teach it? Isn't this just something that people have to feel? It's the old adage.
I think you can totally teach it. Yeah, I mean, if some guy's spent his whole life playing or having a particular penchant for romantic music and then you play him a James Brown record, then, you know, there's a good chance perhaps initially he might not be so down with the beat, but I'm sure by just explaining what to listen for and how to feel it, I'm sure that everybody can groove, basically. It's just a case of trying to unlock it as fast as possible.
And how have you been doing that with the students you've had today?
Well, we just focus on a few really simple tasks or a few simple riffs. And the main thing was what we call, I guess, in the music world, of subdividing and where the emphasis lies, and also upon kind of moving and dancing and putting those things together and working on different exercises, like take one simple riff, if it's not happening immediately, slow it down, effectively like magnifying something in, having a look at it and then get that tight and then speed it up. It's a very simple process, actually. But a lot of classical musicians don't think like that, so. Which is not a bad thing. It's just they don't have to do it.
Yeah. Now, Emily, you've been one of Jules' students in the workshop this afternoon. What do you play?
Well, I brought my violin today, but I play a mixture of things, piano, guitar, singing.
And is this kind of workshop familiar to you? Are you somebody who's needs the groove unlocking, if you like, to use what Jules was saying?
It's funny because you said about classical musicians, I find it harder, and I played violin in orchestras before, and you do find that it's harder for syncopation and things like that for them to really grab it. But because I also play in a band and other things like that, it's a bit easier when you know the more kind of popular music sort of thing. It's just easier if you can pick up a beat. It's like some people get it, some people can't. It doesn't mean you can't teach it to them.
And do you find it's easy to actually bring those things across from the band experiences through to classical composition, if you like?
Oh yeah, no, it's really helpful. It means like you can draw things from different areas of music that you're interested in, because I'm interested in pretty much everything. I can draw things from different areas of music and put it into one thing. So say I was composing something that's classical but maybe a little bit more contemporary, I can take something from jazz or take something from rock that might kind of help that to make it a little bit more quirky. So that's basically what we're dealing with today. So we've got a lot of classical musicians coming, and a lot of the pieces they compose are quite contemporary, but in the kind of improvisational thing we did with Jules, that was very kind of jazzy and more popular music, which is really good because it gets them to think about other things.
Thank you. Now it's time to hear the senior winner's piece from the Young Composers Competition. It's by Sarah Gate. It's called Portrait of a Moor. We're about to hear its first public performance. Now, Sarah, Portrait of a Moor, there's a picture behind this. Explain where the inspiration came from and what image we ought to have in our heads.
Yes, the inspiration was from a picture by James Northcote. It's actually a portrait of the American actor Ira Aldridge in the title role of Shakespeare's Othello, and it's called Othello, the Moor of Venice. And I was just really intrigued by the look on the subject's face, because it's a really jealous look, and his eyes are raised slightly, and around the edges of the painting it's very murky. Then it comes into focus on the features of his face, and I wanted to reflect that in the piece. So the piece moves from a more murky sound world with a lot of unusual techniques to an intense focus.
And you've taken some of the physical aspects of the picture as well, haven't you? The sort of folds and layers that
you can
see.
That's right, and the colour scheme too. The artist used a very restricted colour scheme, just brown, black and white, shades of that. And I've concentrated the harmonic and melodic writing on just two intervals, the fifth and the semitone, and because they're quite contrasting intervals, and based all the pitch material on that to make it quite focused too.